Same thing, and he was like, dude, I just send Andrew an email to his Apple address anytime I want to bitch at him. and he's got nothing to do. He has nothing to do with these products. Like, the last I checked with him, he was like coding something for like the App Store. But nonetheless, you got one friend at Apple, and any Apple problem that you have, it gets taken out on them. Yep.
Yeah. Oh my God, I'd agree with you so much. And the reason why, like, I was skimming through your website today, and it's really interesting, because you come off as a tech guy. I'm being honest. Like, you come off as somebody, you like technology, you like the advancement, you like new and cool things. And, like, what are some of the cool, like, things in technology? I mean, I know you're in the music industry, you're working in your own business. Like, what are the few things that, like, fascinate you? Like, whoa, that's fucking cool, bro.
I think one of the things that's most fascinating to watch is people thinking that AI is going to replace their job, as opposed to AI just being a human enhancer. So AI, the powers of it and the potential of it are just massive. They really compound. If we use GPT, for example, GPT-3 to GPT-4, there's orders of magnitude in between there.
Night and day, literally.
They're just getting warmed up. Yeah, I was looking at some old GPT renderings that I had to do like around this time last year, and then, you know, looking at what you can do on Midjourney or anything now.
It's crazy.
It's really powerful. So I like that a lot. But that said, I don't really incorporate it too much, you know, because for me, and maybe one of the things that I need to work on is using technology more to fill in or to build up weak points for me. Organization, workflow, processes, etc. Not my strong suit, and something that I have just avoided getting on forever. I could definitely use some AI's help there. But in terms of other technologies, let me think. You know, the cybersecurity part of me, I just sold cybersecurity technology. I'm not a practitioner by any means, but in selling it, I wanted to be provide as good of an experience for every practitioner that I was talking to, but then also more deeply understand the industry, what they're buying and why, so that I can have a more relevant conversation. So I learned a lot about it. And when I think about all these devices that are basically connected to the internet, that just opens up a lot of risk. You know, there's some ideas that maybe that F-35 that got lost, it was actually hacked, because anything that's connected to the internet like that, you can hack.
Well, you heard what happened with MGM Entertainment with Caesar's Palace in August. We did episode last week on this. It was bananas. I remember, because you brought this up, I knew somebody that worked in IT. He told me that some of these very large companies, what they'll do is they'll hire staff. They're hackers. They'll hire them to hack their own company to help make sure if there's any loops or any problems, they'll get it before the hackers do. And it's so odd when these things happen. You're like, didn't you guys prepare?
So with that, there's a lot of, so that's called penetration testing. It's a whole industry. And the people who are doing the hacking, the hired hackers, it's within a controlled environment, or you know that it's happening. So that's called red teaming. But then there's some problems, like they will only be given a limited amount of stuff to hack. Sometimes it's not actually for just overall, hey, how could anybody break into this? It's more like, we need to check this box to show that we are still compliant to these other certifications.
Oh, so boy. We
just want you to hack this one thing. And it's like, that's not really the real world. A friend of mine he practices a certain type of, you couldn't even really call it martial arts. It's a martial art in the sense that it has to do with combat. But it's like, when you compare things, you take a martial arts practitioner and the way we think about it, and they're like, yeah, like if I got into a fight on the street, then I would this, this, and this. Mind you, like, I don't train that way, really. I have very limited training. So everything I say here is
like, okay, bro.
Speculation. Yeah, I know. We're getting lost in the groove, dude. We're chilling. I see you over there. So, you know, and that's like, okay, well, what would we do in the school, in the academy, in the octagon if this happens? And it's like, well, what do you do if I pull out a knife and stab you?
Jesus.
You know, like, what do you do if in the real world, like, I just forget that these are rules and it's a fight to the death? And that's kind of like that hacking example. It's like, yeah, dude, I'll just figure out any way to get in there. And the way that most of this stuff happened, I think this is how that happened, is it's usually just a person who calls another person or convinces some person to give them access to something. So it's not really like, I've opened up the mainframe, I'm hacking the matrix. It's more like, hey, David, can you, I forgot my password for this. Can you give me your password? And you're like, wait, who is this? Yeah. And I'm like, dude, it's Michael. We talked like 3 days ago. You remember? No, look, dude, it's really urgent. I'm sorry to bother you. I know you're busy. And you just talk your way in there. That's called social engineering.
Yeah, there's a lot of tactics that are used. The funny thing is that people, when you watch film and entertainment, they get a very fake view of what actual hacking is. You know, it's funny. I was talking with Carissa about this. Sometimes when you're doing a hacking procedure, you may need 4 computers. They may need 4 different proxies. You may need to use multiple different servers, like depending on what you're doing. It's not like an easy, just go into a computer. You're like, I'm in. No, that never works in real life.
It's very, Hollywood hacking is very stylized.
Oh, it is.
Like the guys in the hoodie and the all finesse, this stuff.
Yep. The dark lighting, only a red light that's on. Yeah.
It's like, no, it might just be some man or woman just chilling in a nice spot because they've made a bunch of money from hacking or this kind of underground, and they're just going to work. They have a coffee.
They're chomping.
They've got their little nicotine pouch. See, you're a fellow nicotine enjoyer. Let me see if I can get my nicotine.
Yeah, I'm a person of substance, 100%. I used to be an avid smoker. I used to smoke about a pack and a half a day, and I'm 24, so I haven't smoked cigarettes, about 3.5 years. So, wow. It's not the best thing.
What kind of cigarettes did you smoke?
When I was overseas, I got into Camel Blues. And here in the US, what I always used to love was the light green American Spirits.
Okay, that's nicotine delivery.
Ooh.
I like the sands, dude.
Look at that! Look at that delivery. Listen, it's like quick drop and spat.
Yep. Let's see. So, green spirits. What flavor is that, or what is that?
So, American spirit. Truth be told, I mean, all cigarettes are bad, hands down. There's no such thing as a better cigarette, but they claim that they are a better cigarette, and by that claim is the fact that it's owned by Native Americans.
You don't have to make cigarette disclaimers to me. I fully enjoy tobacco. And I do. Listen, if I can't get a Lucky Strike unfiltered, which is my preference, I go for American Spirit. Blue, typically blue or yellow. I spent the summer at...
Yellows are good. Those are the mellow ones.
My first professional opera gig, every night I would bum cigarettes off of the lighting designer, sound engineer who lived with us. And we would just sit there and smoke a couple of yellow American Spirits. Those, the light blues, or then the turquoise ones. And I will rip the filters off.
Going hard on a full-on 1927, straight in the coal mines.
This country was built on a lot of things. No country's history is perfect. But one thing that is for sure is caffeine and nicotine have been involved since the beginning.
I will be very blunt and straightforward in the fact, working in a workforce, working 9 to 5, I cannot understand how anybody would not survive with nicotine and caffeine. It's just, it's funny because we're both artists. And one thing I love about you is you dabble into different parts of that. I definitely see that, and people kind of forget that sometimes stress relievers, as bad as they are, sometimes it's alcohol, sometimes it's cigarettes, sometimes it's weed, sometimes it's cocaine. But I feel that sometimes when you're in that creative process and you're in that flow and you're trying to figure out things just to get that stress reliever.
It's totally a flow state, totally a stress reliever. Even people think of stress in a lot of different ways, and it's not like this is a big life stress. Sometimes it is. I'm like, we're going to have a tough conversation. Hold on, dude. Let me get my pouch. Or, there's been periods in my life where I want to smoke for it. or if we're, or I want to smoke after it. But I also think that what you're saying about the flow state is really important. And that's either by the chemical processes, dopamine, and also just, you know, turning your brain on of nicotine and caffeine. But it's also, I've trained my brain now at this point, for better or for worse, to be like, all right, am I sitting down to do work? Am I going on a long drive? Are we about to get into flow? Are we going to get into the groove? Well, then, all right, let me pop some nicotine in, like I'm good to go. It's too late for me now to have any caffeine, but yeah, if this was at 11 a.m., you better believe there'd be a double espresso and a Zen pouch.
You want me to give you a little mind fuck?
Fuck my mind.
I actually am not affected by caffeine.
That's amazing. How so did caffeine, you discover that?
I figure that out because I can literally drink a whole entire bottle of Coke and I can pass out.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, and it's odd because I drink coffee every single day, but it does nothing. I don't feel anything. The thing that actually gives me like energy and boost the whole day is like weed and nicotine.
Hey, dude, there we go. That'll do it, dude. If that gets you going, then like you got to have your weed and your nicotine. Now, for me, when I hear that, I want to just jolt you with like six shots of espresso and be like, let me see if you feel a little kick here. Still nothing?
I definitely can feel a kick, but it's odd. Like that part of my brain that stays on.
Have you ever tried detoxing from it to reset your sensitivity?
No. I've never tried that. It's actually a really good idea. I've never thought about detoxing from.
Yeah, if you did like 2 or 3 days, no caffeine, no nicotine, that'll be really hard just because that's like, it's a habit. Not even the hitting the nicotine, but just like it's so easily accessible. If you did like 2 or 3 days like that and stuck it out, yeah, it'll be tough. Learn about yourself because it'll be tough. But then also you might find it'll be like your first time again. You'll take one big rip. You'll take one big sip of espresso. You'll be like, this is the best day ever. Got that
right. I feel you, bro. No, I feel you. It's true. Sometimes just taking a break. You know, I hate this attitude of where we have to like be perfect humans. You know, where you have to perfectly be fit, perfectly be dieting, perfectly be taking supplements, you know, perfectly be taking. Like, it's so unrealistic. Think about it. Like, we all have breaking points. We all get into mind twisters. We all like get into these really stressful environments, right? You got like a million things going on. You can't be perfect all the time. It's just not real.
You know what I think? It's totally not real. And there's like so many meta levels there, dude. That's a really good point. One, it's not real because it's so disconnected from how we are supposed to be. We are not supposed to be packing things into our schedule, trying to optimize for productivity, locked into little boxes, sending emails from our computer, blah, blah, blah. Living in a debt, a perpetual cycle of debt, essentially like not being free. Like that's not how it's supposed to be. I have a friend of mine. She's a mentor and her wife is really a big mentor in my life. And she is Native American. And one of our first conversations that I had, this was back when I was really focused on what it means to be, I mean, I'm still focused on it, but when I had early in my active questioning about it, like what it means to be a man, where is the male rite of passage? You know, did we ever have that in this country? Is it lost? Have we lost something? And I was talking to her about rites of passage in traditional Native American culture. And then that sort of just opened my mind to thinking more about, you know, like what is that like? And so I do, again, only watch like similar to the hacker version of it, but I watch these movies that are Native American themed, like Dances with Wolves, one of my favorite movies of all time. And it's like, that would be, or if you saw the prequel, actually, this is the best one, the prequel to Yellowstone, right? That big famous show. Yellowstone's okay, it's entertaining. The prequel to it is totally different in terms of theme, in terms of the way that it's shot, and it's a different viewing experience. It's amazing.
Hey, it's Dave, and I quickly just wanted to jump in and say, if you've been enjoying the podcast, enjoying this episode, if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, that'll be so greatly appreciated. Because here's the thing, someone might read that review and make the choice if they want to listen to the podcast. You get to help grow this podcast with us. How fucking cool is that? Let's jump back to today's episode.
And it's like, you're just out there on the plains. The main character, the protagonist, she gets involved romantically with a Native American guy. And it's like, if that's the version of it, if it's life or death out on the plains and I'm connected and we have community, everyone supports each other. The living is very simple. We hunt for what we eat. We use all parts of the animal. We honor the animal after we kill it. Like, we're really, it's like the Lion King. Like, we're active participants. Oh, yeah, bro. It's a better, it's like a conscious way of living. It's like conscious participation in it.
Yeah.
That's nice. And it's, and everybody's just trying to sell you something. Like, think about where we get that stuff from. Why do we feel like we need to do that? It's because we're being told by our phones that we need to be more productive. Get this app, get this supplement, get this whatever. So that you can do what? Wake up earlier so that you can work for the man, so that you can pack more shit in your schedule. It's like, dude, I don't want to do that. The more that I become, I actually get, this is, you know, coming from a fellow caffeine nicotine addict, dude. The more that I simplify my life and the more that I try to revert back to a natural way of living, the clearer my mind gets and the more energy I have.
Yeah.
I get so much sun, dude.
I feel you. I mean, I live down here in Florida. One thing, and I love that attitude. I mean, it's a really, it's a great way to understand that we live on a planet, and this planet is made out of trillions of cells and different compounds all coming together to form something. You know, for me, I'm kind of in an early stage of my life. I'm constantly hustling. I'm constantly working. I currently just took on a second job. But the thing about it was, I took on something that I wanted to do.
What'd you do?
I'm working in a gastro bar. It's a new place that opened down in Oakland Park here in South Florida.
Cool.
And I haven't worked in kitchens in several years. But my attitude was like, if I'm going to put more of my time towards something, I want to do something that's going to make me happy, you know? And it took a long time. Like, I've dreamed of something, you know, be able to do something like this for a long time. But it connects you to a part of yourself that you are in control. You know, we like to believe in this philosophy of you're not in control. No, you are. I know there's a lot of debt. I know there's housing crisis. I know there's a lot of shit that's going on. I know being an artist right now is very hard. It's a lot of noise. A lot of people are trying to be artists. A lot of people are trying to be successful. But at the end of the day, the more passionate, the more you care about something, I think others can see that too.
Yep. And you, something you said there makes me think of figuring out what it is that makes you happy, so that it's even, like, if we explored that a little bit, working in a kitchen, what are the meta principles of what makes you feel happy working in the kitchen?
Wow, you're going deep, honey. Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. For me, I grew up in a Moroccan home. My father was from Casablanca, not the movie.
That's a good movie, though.
Great movie. Funny thing, actually, little thing. Casablanca was a huge hit in Morocco, like massive.
Really?
That people like would go crazy over Humphrey Bogart, to the point, if you ever just want to Google like Morocco back in like the 40s and 50s, tons of people dressed like Humphrey Bogart. It's hilarious. But anyway, my dad learned how to cook from his mom. And my dad taught me how to cook, and he taught my other siblings how to cook too. And the problem that I've had, and I want to hear your thoughts on this, because I know that you've worked with orchestras, and when you're in, you know, that type of environment where you have to like be in coordination and on key, and it's kind of similar with kitchens. Like, if you work in a kitchen, you're here, you do this, we must get this, we must meet this time. Everybody's got to work in pattern. It's like literally a kitchen is a food symphony. In a way. But I never enjoyed the people that I worked on top of me. They were always stressing me out and making me feel miserable. So I had a very disheartening towards it. But the difference is that when you're in a very welcoming environment, imagine yourself being in an orchestra that's very welcoming. Everybody has ideas. Everybody's throwing things around. Everybody wants to talk to each other. Everyone wants to hear what everybody has to say. You create this open-minded environment. That's what I thrive and live for is open-minded environments, because that's where actual change happens.
Do you have, in that, I've sat in and eaten in kitchens in some fancy restaurants. Like, there's on the East Coast, one of the, it's the only 3-star outside of Washington, D.C., where I was at for a few years. The inn at the Little Washington, I sat in the chef's kitchen.
Oh, damn. Look at you.
And got to watch Patrick do his thing.
Damn.
Is there a, in the kitchen that you're in, is there one, there's a collaborative environment, but is there one strong leader that ties everything together and makes the executive calls?
The owner.
And the owner's back there in the kitchen with you?
He sometimes is, yeah. He definitely, he's definitely very much very hands-on. The, you know, you bring up an excellent point, because a lot of times people forget financial, the one that's investing the business. You know, business owners in ways can be very artistic, because even though they're all about money and figures, they're also trying to figure out, okay, we're trying to make this, so how can we, what's the vibe? Like, what are we serving? What type of food are we trying to make? He comes with that type of perspective. And for some people, they're like, oh, that's so corporate America. And I'm just like, I kind of enjoy it, because I'm not a business savvy person. I'm not an entrepreneur by any regards. But having that in that type of environment is can be very successful down the road.
I think it makes you feel, I think that for a creative person, you want to feel useful. And there's also things that you don't want to think about. And if you're forced, if you have to think about them, it takes a long time to develop yourself to where you can get into a flow state to be creative and then switch gears and become more administrative. But I also think that every person can be creative. You know, it's not necessarily about, are you acting? Are you performing? Are you writing, et cetera? Acting, being on stage itself, is inherently pretty blue collar. You're really not creative if, in certain ways of thinking about it, but the act of writing something and getting it up on its feet, directing, that is creative. But I think that if you, anybody who alchemizes something and then can do so consciously and deliberately after that is creative. So if that's creating a business, creative. It could be a restaurant, it could be a construction, it could be something in supply chain, whatever. I think that's creative. And I think what's your definition of entrepreneur or entrepreneurial? Because you've done something that most people, myself included, dream about and then either do a little bit and fail to follow through or never do at all, which is start a podcast.
I've been doing this for about 2 years, so I'm in like the top 10%, which is crazy. It's kind of baffling, because when people tell me, oh, people fail doing podcasting after one episode, it's very hard for me to understand. I think the reason it's very hard for me to understand is this takes time. I'm going to be listening to this podcast in 3 years from now, let's just say 2027. And I'm going to be completely different. The way that I'm talking with people, the way I'm interacting, because you are teaching me something for the next hour that you've already told me a bunch of things that I had no idea. So that in mind, it's a slow process, but you can see it as you progress throughout it. You can see all of the steps that you go through. And I've seriously had this conversation with so many people over and over and over again. It is a slow process. You know, why am I not good at podcasting? It takes time, honey.
I don't know. How many podcasts have you done? Like that's like the person who would rhetorically ask, why am I not good at podcasting? Well, how many have you done?
Over 200.
Yeah. Dude, a friend of mine here in Austin, this guy named Danny Miranda.
Are you in Austin, Texas?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, you're in one of the freedom states. Thank God. Okay. Yeah, I'm listening.
Well, I'm about to move to New York City, so we'll
buckle up.
Well, I'm ready. I'm ready for whatever. And we can talk about this in a second, because my perspectives have really changed. But Danny talks a lot on Twitter about his process and the ups and downs. And how he's highly aware of his growth through each of these phases, you know, like one to like 150, he was getting some traction. 150 to like 250 was really slow and a lot of doubt and a lot of hurdles. And then after that, it's like something clicked and it just rocket shipped off. And I think that when I think about that something clicking, it's almost like a visual that comes to mind is like you're chipping at a rock or a boulder with a hammer, and you have 1,000 cracks, and at 1,000 hits, it's going to crack open and it's going to reveal whatever's inside. But at hit 998 and it hit 999, you have no indication that you're one hit away from it unfolding.
So you can't see it.
On persevering. Yeah. One of my mentors has this saying that's goes something like, you know, the path is illuminated only when you walk it. So I spent a lot of time in my life trying to get things really perfect and sorted in my mind before I actually took any action. And that really did me a big disservice. When I think back to, you know, like you were saying, you're going to watch this in 3 years, it'll be totally different. When I look back at my early creative efforts in the way of getting on the internet, personal branding, et cetera, of getting my voice out there, I was right about everything. Dude, like some of the stuff that Dan Coe has, I just came across his website and I was like, I was thinking of the words, and this leads me to a good point. Have you read the book by Creative Act, A Way of Being by Rick Rubin?
No, but I did watch the documentary he did where he went into, I've watched a few Rick Rubin documentaries. He did go into a little bit length of the book, but I never actually read it. No.
So he's really good. So some of the stuff that Dan Coe has on there, one thing that stood out to me was high energy lifestyle. And 6 or 7 years ago, when I was really starting to dial up, you know, my fitness entrepreneurship, and that was one of the ways that I was supporting myself was by offering fitness and nutrition services. I was thinking about conversations that I was having with clients, how I felt, what I was eating. And I was like, this is like the high energy diet, high energy program, because it's all principle based. It's a high energy lifestyle. And I didn't do anything with it. And sure enough, I go on Dan Coe's website. He's got millions of followers. He's doing great for himself and he's doing a lot of good for the world. And it's this, 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 and a high energy lifestyle. And I was like, I was right, but I didn't do anything with it. And one of the things that Rick Rubin says in his book is this, he explains that this idea is that ideas are not really yours.
Right.
Just, it's an idea. It's in the ether. You, if you are tapped in, if you're calibrated, if you're vibrating at a certain frequency, you get access to it. But somebody else has access to it too. This happened, you know, a couple of years ago as well in the opera world. I had this idea that, you know, if I could do something, if I could structure this thing in this way, network with these people, create this thing, this is what it would be. And it would be a huge value add. I didn't do anything with it. And sure enough, somebody else did.
Yeah.
Everything happens for you and for a reason. So like, there's a reason that it took me so long to do that. But nonetheless, like, yeah, dude, all those ideas are out there. They're not ours. We just channel them.
You know what proof of that is? The name of this podcast. I've said this story many times. Lost in the Groove is actually a record shop out in Washington State. So cool. They've had our name before us as a podcast. So to emphasize on Rick Rubin's point, like, somebody, the idea was there. It was in the air. Somebody else took it a long time ago, and I took it again. But what is very strange is we both had the same idea. So if you know a vinyl record, the indents that are in the record itself, they're called grooves. So lost in the groove. You get lost in the record. So their record shop makes sense. By podcasts, all about artists and podcasters alike, you know, and all kind of fun and interesting people. And
getting into a flow state. And then there's
same idea.
There's somebody, and somebody can take that same idea and they can have a totally different execution.
Make a restaurant. I'm not just kidding. You can make a restaurant out of Lost in the Groove.
Yep. What records have you gotten Lost in the Groove on?
So actually, the logo for this podcast is the record of John Lennon's 1971 album, Imagine. So that, I think the track that would emphasize more anything like the start of the podcast would probably be God.
I don't know that track. That's cool.
I can send it to you later. It's really good.
Please do. What other records have you gotten Lost in the Groove on?
I'm a big fan. You know, my parents as a kid, my parents were an interesting couple. They were interracial. My mom grew up in a very, she grew up in the projects in Williamsburg. You know, she grew up in a kind of a Jewish, it doesn't exist anymore. It's called, what's the word? It's called, Agudas Yisrael. It's a certain sect. And then my dad was an immigrant. And the thing about the two of them was like their music dynamic was simply Simon and Garfunkel, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan. My dad loved Earth, Fire, and Wind, Bee Gees, Cher. My mom loves Cher, especially her early work in the 60s. You put on a Cher track and my mom's dancing away to it. I grew up around a lot of 60s, 70s American and Middle Eastern Moroccan music. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Those are all genres, artists that I somehow missed, but my parents were also playing a lot of 60s, 70s. Ours was Beatles, Beach Boys, Tony Bennett and Bill Evans. That album for me was totally transformative. Huge influence on my life.
It's like a movie. It's like literally listening to a movie. That's what I always say.
Dude, so perfect. Then what else did we listen to a lot of? Ravi Shankar.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, Ravi Shankar was in there. And then for me, I got really into Red Hot Chili Peppers early on. There's actually a great, in Anthony Kiedis' biography, another formative influence in my life. I read that like three times in eighth grade. He lived with Cher.
Commitment.
With Sonny and Cher. Yeah. Commitment.
When they were married?
I think so. I'm pretty sure. Mind you, it was a long time ago.
How old is he now?
Anthony Kiedis, he's like 50 something.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Out there in LA.
I did not know that he's that old.
I know, he looks good. I'm telling you, it's because he's about that natural living, dude. He's outside in the sun, like, he wearing no shirt and just singing, dancing, staying creative and staying connected. Keeps you young forever. Like, look at Mick Jagger. He looks amazing.
And he's around by, I think he's older than Biden.
Yep. I saw that. Yeah. Like that comparison of vitality. Tony Bennett, dude, rest in peace. 98, singing until the day he died. And even losing his faculties to Alzheimer's.
Betty White.
Yep, exactly. The track comes on and he's still sharp. So there's that. But then I also would get really into 50 for me, like 50 Cent. 50 Cent's album, Get Rich or Die Tryin', major influence. Jay-Z's Black album, major influence. And then some musicals. Last 5 years was a big one. All of these, like, I've got committed to memory. You put one of them on, I'm good to go.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because that attitude doesn't really exist anymore. Because back in, I'm saying back in the day, I'm in my 20s, we used to have tapes and CDs,
I used to have tapes and CDs. I don't know if you did.
No, I had tapes and CDs. I had a tape player. Okay, we had a CD stereo system. Oh, we had CRTVs. Oh, trust me. I remember.
Things start skipping.
Oh my God. I hated CDs. I hated CDs so much with a passion. The problem was also like they cost money. So yeah. Every single time you wanted to buy music, it was like, and this is the lie that they did. Cause I remember like tapes were super cheap. The problem is like you have to rewind them. You know, you'd always like keep the, I love these. Remember you used to keep the ballpoint pen? I used to.
Oh yeah.
Just screw to it. Be able to. Different time. And we like, I feel like, you know, you just would listen to the music over and over and over and over and over. Cause like it, you spent money on this. Like you just spent like $5.
Good point. Or you spent a bunch of time downloading it from LimeWire.
I don't remember that.
The LimeWire for me, that was like seventh or eighth grade. So you must have been two or three.
I remember when they had iTunes and you'd buy music from there. The way you used to do it back in the day was you would have a cable and you connect it into your iPod.
Oh yeah.
And you used to get a little pop up like your iPod was connected and you just drop the music in. Oh my God.
The original iPod was a masterpiece. It had the buttons and the the thing and you could fast forward with the circle. I love
that. You could hear the thing spinning inside.
Yep. Oh, it was so satisfying, dude. Like, you know what? Maybe that's what I'll email my friend. I'm going to be like, Andrew, bring back the OG iPod. It would slap. That thing would sell so hard if somebody could buy an OG iPod again, or like a mock-up paying homage to it. But so in between iTunes and CDs, there was, and like going to the store and buying CDs, there was like file sharing where you could basically steal or rip music from
CD just, burners.
Yeah. So you'd plug into Kazaa, LimeWire, or like BitTorrent. And you
I remember Kazaa. I don't remember LimeWire though.
Yep. And you just download them. And then the original, of course, is Napster, but I was a little bit late to the game for Napster.
Yeah. It's so weird because, you know, there was the trend back in the day that like people used to make mix CDs. And what happened, especially in New York, if you know, you're moving out there, you might be curious about this. The DJ scenes back in the early 2000s, a lot of rap, hip hop artists, what they do is they make mixes. So a bunch of them would come together. They'd make a mix. They'd give it to the DJ. They'd, you know, they'd harass, come on. Come. And then they would play a bunch of these songs. DJ would do his thing. And it's all of these different artists, but they would burn it onto a CD because you're able to do that. And it was all because one person knew how to do it. Only one person knew how to. Nobody knew, like, dude, can you do this, bro? Can you put this together? And it kind of created like this really great community. Like everybody's like, oh, I want to hear this. Oh, I want to try that.
And that person is creative. They might not have written the songs. They might not have performed the songs. But they could take the songs and arrange them in a certain way or do what you needed them to do. Like everyone is creative.
That was the beginning for independent artists' freedom to break away from record labels, because before that, I mean, how are you going to produce music? You need tens of thousands of dollars of equipment.
You need a huge infrastructure, which is what's so exciting. And I guess back to your original question about technology, the fact that we have great internet everywhere and iPhones, even non-iPhones, right? I just don't want to see a green text from anybody. But
neither do I.
You know, the fact that, dude, we've got these things, you can shoot a full movie on them. You can
4K. Shoot
high quality, you can take high quality pictures, headshots, and then you can just create an account on one of the many social media platforms and share what you're doing, and then use some different platforms, connect them, and ask people for money to pay for your art. Like Michelangelo would have had a field day. The total decentralization of what it takes to create. You don't need this big infrastructure. You don't need to wait to be discovered. You just go put it out there, keep going, and 2 years later, you're discovered. And the other thing there is, like, you know, people really ask themselves, why do they want to be discovered? What does that even mean? Is it that you want to be making money from your art, from what you do? Or is it that you want to be mainstream, famous, and known? Because if you have have you heard of the thousand true fans theory?
No, but can you elaborate? Now I'm curious.
Would love to. So the thousand true fans is this idea that you only need 1,000 what are known as true fans in order for you to make a good, if not great, living just off of creating and producing whatever your art is. So a true fan is somebody who will buy, without really looking or investigating it, whatever it is that you put out every single time. And if you have 1,000 of them, you can produce enough stuff at not super high, still pretty accessible price points for you to make a nice living.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a really great point, because you have to be able to separate superstar and being a successful artist. Because let's be real, I mean, it would be nice to be like Cardi B or Post Malone, but realistically, the chances of getting there is zero. So your chances of, like you said, you know, getting to 1,000 followers, it may take 2 years, may take 5, true followers. But you may not be super famous, but you have a career. You have a stable foundation to work with.
Yep. And then you need to ask yourself, why do you want to be famous? If you're going to kick yourself and feel like, I'm not perfect, I should be more famous, like, what is fame like? Do you really want that? You can't go anywhere without being stopped or harassed for a selfie or something like that. You have no privacy. You have people who stalk you and come try to like find out where you live.
We're all about the artist. That is the whole purpose of this podcast, period. And you have a really valuable tool. You can share this with artists, people that are creative, someone that can enjoy this podcast and really enjoy the experience of Lost in the Groove. So with that, let's jump back to today's episode, shall we?
People who try to wreck your life and reputation, like, it's not for everybody. Do you want to be famous, or do you just want to make great art and not have to, and have that be your sole focus? And really, the difference is that it just is for those who are have enough audacity to start putting themselves out there, and then the relentlessness and the discipline to stay consistent.
It's hard. It's not an easy feat, you know. And the thing about, you mentioned, you know, keeping in the fact that you don't have any privacy on, you know, on top of that, there's so many other things in life to work towards. You know, look, some of my biggest inspirations are like people like David Bowie, Freddie Mercury, John Lennon, but these were super famous people. Unfortunately, they all died tragic deaths. Now, I always think about this. Oh my God, all my mentors died tragic deaths. But anyway, on a positive note, they all left something that so many artists can take from. Like, I personally feel I could take so many things from John, and there's so many things I can take from Freddie and make of my own. And I feel the same thing for you. I mean, you know, as an opera singer and using your voice and using your creativity to create, even mentioning your people that inspire you, it's not what you need to be famous. It's what you need to be successful.
Well, you need to be successful, and then the base work in there is like, how are you defining art for yourself? It's just some way through which you express yourself. And what is expressing yourself? It's really just revealing more of yourself to yourself and getting closer to God or to your purpose or to however you want to call it, by mastering yourself and then expressing that through your crafts. So if you could be laying bricks, or, you know, I've had a lot of weird jobs in my life, like dishwashing. If you just can commit to being present at dishwashing and say every dish that I wash is going to be better than the last one, I'm going to get better at this today, and I'm going to take pride in my work, you're an artist. What you got about dishwashing?
Believe it or not, that is the most important job in the kitchen.
No kidding.
Yes. Why? The reason dishes is important is, as a cook, as in a chef, if you can be able to clean and do it masterfully, then even more so, you can do that with the food that you make. But if you can't put yourself to wash dishes, why on earth are you making food?
Ooh. Explain more.
Because it all ties together. You know, the utensils you're using, the plates you're using, the things that you're serving, right? You want to present your craft to somebody. If you don't care about dirty dishes or washing them or taking care of that, where is the love and passion in putting that onto that dish or that basket or to that bowl, or putting the sauce into the little, you know, little tiny little dishes? I love those. It's just you can't choose one over the other. You need to master both to be a good chef and a cook.
Because how you're going to do everything, how you do anything, is really how you do everything. And what I hear there is you've got to have the humility to be able to take what some people, at least from the outside, would consider to be the quote unquote lowliest position in the kitchen, but then also be able to take those lessons of what makes a great dishwasher great and take them to the highest position in the kitchen. And leadership is the master skill. That standard, that example, trickles down to everybody. And so if that's how you're operating, with humility and great energy and attention to your craft and a love for the process with an eye for the, and a standard for the end result, I mean, now you're cooking, dude. Now you're lost in the groove of art. Like, being lost in the groove, you've got to be, for me, being lost in the groove is just about presence. So much of my life is, I'm very committed to simplifying, but so much of my life is designed to help me get into a flow state, become present in what I'm doing faster and longer.
Yeah. I really wanted to have a place where artists can talk with artists. You know, it's funny because you're in Austin, Texas, and I listened to Joe Rogan podcast, and he did that with, you know, comedians. And I was just thinking to myself, like, why can't there be a place for artists? You know, there's other podcasts that are doing something similar to mine, but like you said, getting into that flow state as artists and creators, it's just a fun place to be. We get to be passionate about things that we love, dig deep into things that we want to experience and learn from one another. It's just, it's a matter of how much are you willing to do? How much are you willing to take? And how much are you willing to sacrifice? And understand that if you want to be a successful artist, you need to understand what that means before you even start.
What else is in there is how much are you willing to suck?
Damn. Oh, right in the heart. Ugh.
You know, blood everywhere. How is episode number 3 compared to what episode number are we on here?
I don't know. I think this would probably be 167. This probably would be like 205. Maybe.
What's different for you from 205 to number 5?
When I first started this podcast, I didn't really have a very clear direction as to what I wanted to do. You know, and I kind of dabbled and tried a few other things. But I eventually just realized that the less I focused and the more I just was in the moment, that's when the pieces started coming together.
Yep. There's the trying to have it all figured out and then just having just enough figured out and letting the universe deliver the rest to you, I think is really important. What's your 9 to 5?
I work in a call center.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, really exciting.
Is there a certain element of creativity to it?
No. None.
Maybe.
No, there really isn't. There really isn't any type of creativity. I mean, I'm refilling CPAP supplies for patients. So,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of, I needed a second job, and that's kind of the reason why I chose to be in a kitchen, because I get to spend at least some time of my working in something that I want to do. And I'm sorry, because I didn't really like touch base on this. You mentioned something about your voice. Did you? Mm-hmm. Did you mention? Okay. Do you want to elaborate on that more? Because I'm actually kind of curious.
Like what I'm doing for pay now.
Like in regard, because I know you did opera and you were a part of an orchestra, and then I know that you did that for like 10 or 12 years.
Yeah. So, and there's this funny thing in the what I call the American opera industrial complex.
Oh my God.
They put it into your head from an early age, deliberately or, you know, by accident, that if you do anything else, if you take another job, if you get paid from not singing, that you're a quitter and that you're less than, that you're not committed, that you're whatever. So there's this big stigma around leaving, even if you're not quitting, but that you go do something else. And it's like, no, you'll be blacklisted or whatever.
Damn.
Which is, yeah, it's tough. And I don't think that it's deliberate, because one of the people who is seen as a figurehead of delivering this message, she says, and this is just maybe people don't listen or they don't connect the dots, or they only want to hear what they want to hear. She's like, you know, I had a paralegal job. I was I did this or that. Like when I was in New York trying to make it back in the day as a singer, and there's no shame in doing that. You got to do what you got to do to be able to afford lessons. You know, it's expensive. But I worked in cybersecurity sales for 2 years, selling software from what I would call coronavirus season 2 through coronavirus, you know, up to season 3 and 4. I got laid off this past April.
So true.
And then I and before that, I was a professional opera singer. So yeah, working with orchestras, working in companies, etc. And I connected some dots in there, which was basically, hey, what if I helped people who were doing my job or who had a similar customer-facing role use their voice in a more authentic and engaging way to get what they want, to get attention faster and to hold it longer. So in the cybersecurity world, there's a very contentious relationship between the, as a cute cat, what's this cat's name?
Her name is Twix.
Hey, what's up, Twix?
She's the official producer of the podcast.
She is. Twix, you're doing good. How do we sound? So there's this very contentious relationship between, let's call them the big dogs who buy the cybersecurity software, the main cyber person in an organization, the chief information security officer, and vendors, sales reps who are trying to sell. A lot of these vendors have very tactless, non-personal outreach, and they have some traits that they bring to conversations if they are fortunate enough to get on one that are not very engaging and come off in a way that really is not great for either person, doesn't get either person what they want. So what I started doing was helping people to get attention faster and hold it longer on these cold calls, and then help them shape and synthesize what they're actually saying to be relevant for this person. And that expanded into, or really it started with helping creators and entrepreneurs sound better on calls. Guys, for example, really want to have a deeper, more commanding, more masculine voice, or they don't like the sound of their voice. So what I do is I basically just help people sound in a way that they really love, that gets them what they want without being false.
I'm gonna stay neutral. Well, okay, I'll be honest. The thing is, working in customer service, and I've been doing it for about 4 years, I've kind of developed this straight up, I don't sound like this when I'm on a phone with the person. It's hilarious. I sound sometimes a little robotic, a little animatronic, but I've never thought about it in that like regard. You know, when you're calling people, I guess because of, you know, the type of thinking you go into it, you know, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, you want me to do this? All right, I'll do.
And that's where you start to bring in that craft that you apply to other areas. You bring it into what you're doing. So for me, I mean, this started as, I didn't realize what I was doing when I was doing it, but started as gamifying things. You know, if I'm going to call 100 people, if I'm going to do the same demo and have the same basically conversation flow, what can I do each time to make it better? What can I do to get more out of it, to move it better for everybody, to learn something new each time? And this looks in a bunch of different ways. How do I respond to this question about our product? How do I change what I'm saying or how I'm saying it when they first answer the phone, or the second or third question that I ask, if I even ask a question at all? And that very much is like, you know, how do I wash this dish better and faster? How do I be more organized so that the flow of the kitchen can be more productive? Looking at that then changes everything. And it goes back to these other skills. Like for me, I'm a huge meathead. That's the way that you stay present and get the most out of every single rep and every single set. And then you build the other skill of discipline and consistency. So you go when you don't want to go, and you just don't ever let one miss turn into two. And then you start doing that to everything. There's areas in my life that I don't do that in that I need to work on. But with this, you know, I put that together, and then I teach them some basic vocal technique things, not really basic, but we work towards a certain sound, and I use this vocal training background and experience to help pull it out of you, and then figure out how it is learning from you. How do you think? Are you kinesthetic, or are you, you know, what sense do you gravitate towards to describe sensations? Do you even have that awareness at all? And then we look at the, what are you saying? What's your goal? So what's the voice? Can you give us a demonstration of the voice that you use in the call center?
Oh my God. Okay, I'm going to use generic names just for the sheer reference. I do not want to mention my jobs in this podcast. Thank you for calling System Medical. This is Dave from the resupply department. How can I help you today?
Okay. What I heard in there is good. The how can I help you today? Good. Thank you for calling. This is Dave. Good for me. A little bit more forward, a little bit disconnected from the chest than I've heard you speaking previously.
Told you.
Yeah.
It's different.
It's good though. But that's, again, dude, it's a common problem that a lot of people run into is, how do I bring my authentic self? How do I let my personality, creativity shine through in this work environment?
It's interesting because I've learned how to be able to talk better because I've been doing podcasting. A lot of the times we add in additive words, and I've slowly been able to get those out of my vocabulary. I mean, it takes time, you know, like ums and ands and likes. But as you learn to, you learn the right etiquette, the way to approach and to talk with somebody, it becomes less and less of a problem because you could figure out in your head how you want to put sentences. Right now, I'm figuring out how to put sentences together in my head.
And the reps have paid off. You speak super well. I do this day in and day out for all kinds of people from everywhere. And you speak super well. I wonder what it would be like if you considered treating each one of those calls like a podcast.
Oh my God. You're just twisting my mind this whole time, my man.
You know, it'd be more fun.
Possibly.
For sure.
100%.
There's more play. I'm really big on this state of play. This, if you can get into a state of play, everything is better. You know John Cleese? Monty Python?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So John Cleese had a second career as a business consultant. And John Cleese has this speech, this idea that he talks about called open mode versus closed mode. Closed mode is when you've got the plan. You're like, let's do the numbers. Let's do blah, 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 blah. But open mode is when you're going to do something creative. And it's when no hierarchy exists. So you could have the CEO and the dishwasher in the same room. And they're solving a problem. And they just start throwing out ideas. And every idea is just as valid as the next. And there's no judgment. And one of the best ways for open mode, the way that he suggests open mode starting, is you have to start with some kind of a joke or something that gets people to laugh. And it puts them into this state of openness.
It's kind of interesting you bring that up, because the thing that comes to mind when I think of closed mode is chairman of the board. That room where no one is allowed in except the elites of the company. And it's like, I get it. I understand these are hired professionals for their job, but don't you think it would be a good idea to get somebody that's actually on the phones, you know, people that are actually working in those departments you're trying to fix? It's just one of those ironic things. It's weird. No wonder we have no change. We're still stuck in the 80s when we're snorting cocaine through the wazoo and making cars look like they were fucking Tonka trucks. Just squared lines all over the place. Houses looked even worse. Just squares everywhere, you know? Like, do we really want to live like that?
There's no taste. There's no connection. There's no anything. And then even in that boardroom, if nobody else is going to be involved, they're still solving a problem. So maybe they need to start off with watching something that makes them laugh. Like, you know what makes me laugh my ass off? Scenes from The Birdcage. I was watching this the other day. I was going to post something. And
oh my God, are you serious?
Have you seen The Birdcage?
I have to see a cover of it. Hold on.
Robin Williams, Hank Azaria, Nathan Lane.
I think I know you're talking about. I'm dyslexic. I should have mentioned that. I never mention this to guests. And I have this thing where I remember, especially with movies, I remember posters. You show me a poster of a movie. Oh my God. Oh my God. I think I know which movie you're talking about.
Yeah, there were some scenes in there, and I posted something, and it reminded me of this scene in there where Hank Azaria is forced to wear shoes, and he never wears shoes, and he just can't walk in them at all. And he's,
yes, I know what movie this is.
And I watched it, and I watched the scene, and I just was just on a walk, dude. Again, just getting some sun, getting my 20K steps in, and I just laughed my ass off on the street. And then I watched these other scenes. I hadn't seen them in a while. I've seen them a million times. I quote them. I'm just like, it's so perfect.
Do you want to think funny about that movie?
Yeah.
It was not critically acclaimed.
Well, critics are wrong, dude.
I know they are wrong. And it's kind of interesting because to see those two type of comics, that's what I love. I love when you have movies of, what if you take this comic and that comic? Like Kevin Hart, Dwayne Rock Johnson's not a comic, but Kevin is. Take Kevin Hart and put Dwayne Rock Johnson. Or, they never done, I don't know if they've ever done this before, Kevin Hart and Jack Black. And Will Ferrell.
I think that's Jumanji. Jumanji would be the first two. Well, and the first three, really, because you've got Kevin Hart, Jack Black, and old
DJ. So funny too. Oh my God, they're so. That is the magic right then and there, is when you take two really crafty, talented people and you're like, put them together. And like you said, it makes you laugh all the time. And it's because they're really good at what they do.
Nathan Lane. Ah, I pierced the toast. You pierced the toast. So what? I so love Robin Williams, dude. Watching Robin Williams just always puts a smile on my face. I love that man.
Yeah, it's sad. It's sad what happened. I mean, it kind of reminds you of what can happen sometimes for artists, even successful ones. You can get in this stage of very deep depression, and you're just not happy. You know, you remember what you said earlier about being famous, what comes with it. You know, you don't really have privacy. You don't have anybody to really talk to that you can depend on. I mean, think about all the people that have died and that were movie stars and people that were artists. I mean, it's just.
Everyone's going to die, dude. That's what everyone's got in common. Taxes and debt. And one you can avoid, and then maybe you can avoid the IRS, but you definitely can't avoid death, which is why I just like to remind myself, you know, some people like to think, you know, memento mori, you're going to die someday. I just prefer to think it's not that serious. It's not that serious. Just live more of your life in a state of play.
But you know what you can do is, this is what I loved about David Bowie more than anything, is he created his eulogy. Was his last album, Black Star. Oh my God, I tell this to everybody. Listen to Black Star. It is the best album he's ever made. And that is like the crowning achievement. Like the man, I mean, not everybody has the opportunity to know that they're going to die. But imagine you're in that predicament where you're told that you're going to die in a, you know, a certain amount of time. And instead of groveling and feeling sorry for yourself, what do? You spend your time creating.
It's another way of thinking about living your life. Hey, if you knew that you were going to die tomorrow, what would you want to get done? Would you want to write that album? Would you want to make that play? Would you want to do this, have this experience or that experience? And then we need to train ourselves. This is, again, part of the societal conditioning, because a lot of what we were saying about that hustle culture, that et cetera, that comes from the way that we are taught and trained and educated in schools. School starts at 7:20, it gets out at like 3:30, whatever, and it's just back to back to back to back classes that have nothing to do with each other. It's not how your brain works. It's not how your attention span works. It's bad for your circadian rhythm. It's everything. But then if you train yourself to think about wants instead of what you don't want, you know, ask people, hey, name 10 things that you want. They'll be like, well, I don't want this. I don't want this. It's like, cool, but what do you want? What are you pulling yourself towards? What are you pulling into your life?
Do you want to do that right now? Do you want to name 10 things that you want and I can name 10 things I want?
Yeah, material things or experiences.
Wow, we're going deep. You choose, roll the dice.
Let's go experiences, 10 things you want.
I want to experience rehabilitation with ayahuasca in Peru. It's one thing that I would eventually want to do. I would like to spend more time with my best friend.
What do you guys want to do together? What's an experience you want to have?
Well, Chris is also the host of American Groove. One thing we love to do is just drive and go to the beach or just walk around and just walk into a record store or find a cool place or something. And I really, like, another thing that I cherish is creating memories. You know, it's kind of weird. Like, I barely have any photos of myself. I barely have any photos of places that I've been. And the reason is because I don't really need to just sit there and snap photos all the time. It's like I'm there to spend time with people and friends. That's four, right? Four. Okay. Number five would be to have more time with Twix.
What do you want to do with Twix?
I want to be able to, she loves to go outside, be able to get her out, be able to spend more time with her, you know, and just like you said, just be more connected. It, you know, one thing that I'm trying more than anything is just to get more connected to myself and the things that I want to do, not the things that I don't want to do. Understanding what you have control of and things you don't have control of. It's another one that's important. My God, Damn it, man. Cherish the time that I have with my mom.
What do you want to do with your mom?
Well, I actually live down here because of my mom. So right now I don't really have a lot of time to spend with her. You know, eventually where I can kind of get control of my finances and be able to, and that's another thing, is also be able to manage my time. And I think the last thing more than anything is to slow down.
Mm. Mm-hmm. That's powerful, dude. How's that feel? 10. Yeah, how's that feel stretching to come up with those things?
It feels like a bandage, you know, like a thick Band-Aid bandage you put on your leg, you know, and as men, we got hair down there and you just rip that motherfucker right off.
Yep. That's good. All right, you go. Start training your brain. You start training your brain to think like that. For me, I want to produce and star in a film adaptation of Leonard Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti. I want to write and perform and produce and get it out there, an original album of music.
Oh my God. You haven't released an album?
Dude, I used to write songs all the time. And they're not bad. I asked one of my creative partners. Creative partnership is so important. I had a really great creative partner my senior year of high school, and I asked him to send me any recordings that he had of us. He would play some guitar licks, and I would just start writing lyrics and come up with a melody and a hook. I was like, these are pretty good. Actually pretty good.
That's a good thing to work towards.
Yep. So
you
I'd like
do
to
that.
Do, I'd like to do that. I would love to live in New York City. I want to live in New York City.
There you go.
Yep. Getting on it. I want to fly private.
I'm not gonna lie, I would like to fly, but I would like to fly a private vintage jet. What about you?
Oh, that'd be very cool. Oh, I want to fly on a big old private Gulfstream from 2024. I want to go on the big dog. I want to experience being out at sea on a mega yacht, big luxury yacht.
Oh, I feel you. That's a lot of fun.
I want to sing on stage in a principal role in a opera that I like at the Metropolitan Opera.
Ooh.
Yeah. I want to play the role of Billy Bigelow in Carousel in a company that I really have a lot of respect for.
Damn.
I want to be in a feature film. Again, one either that I produce or create or just somebody hires me to star in.
Mm-hmm.
I want to...
Got number 10.
I want to be fluent in Italian and have my citizenship to match.
Wow. It's kind of funny because I'm technically 37% Italian and I got no citizenship.
Well, do you have Moroccan citizenship?
Technically, yes.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm working on getting my Italian citizenship, my Italian passport.
Italy is, it's another level. And I mean, as an artist, you can just walk around with your guitar, you know, or start painting. When I went to Rome, and it's so interesting, like it's a busy city, but it's kind of busy and touristy in the best of ways. Because like nobody's bothering you, and Italians, they just get in your face and they just make you happy. That's what I love about Italians. They're in your face and it's just a beautiful culture. I definitely see why art comes from Italy.
Oh yeah.
And on this podcast, I will say hands down, Italians make wine hella better than French. I'm sorry.
Ooh, it's a spicy take.
I prefer Italian wine.
You got to go to, this is one of my regrets, is that when I was in Florence, I spent a month studying in Florence in graduate school. They sent us over there to learn Italian to be better opera singers. And a friend and I we took a day trip to Siena. And we were too poor to justify, or that really the price tag for a case, maybe they were individual bottles, of Brunello freaked us out. But Brunello is the wine from Italy, and we were in the home of Brunello, and we didn't buy any.
Aww.
I know. And we had a great time. I don't drink anymore. It'll be 7 years of no booze tomorrow.
Wow. But we had 7 years.
Yep, but we had a great time getting wasted on some on some cheap wine, swigging from the bottles, Ricardo and I.
That's one thing I always tell people: if you want to get wasted and have a good time in the, you know, like in the clubs or just go around, gotta go to Europe, gotta go to Italy or Germany. I don't know about Paris.
Paris is an amazing city.
It's you need money. You need a lot of money. Like even the cheap thing, like, you know, they do the cheap things on Instagram. You get those videos and stuff. It's like, bro, like 30 euros is not cheap for most Americans.
Nope.
Sorry.
That's the thing, dude. We just got to say we want to have financial freedom. Add that.
Oh, yeah. What do you you know what? That's an interesting thing we should get into. What do you what are your thoughts on financial freedom and your thoughts of especially for artists getting there?
Artists have got to do it. You've got to at least learn some skills that are going to allow you to either be free enough to not have to worry about money and make art and creating art your full-time thing, if that is what you desire. Or if you can scratch the itch, you go to your job, it fulfills you, and then you scratch the itch on your own time. But whether that's figuring out how to get paid for your art or to get somebody else to pay for your art, those it's just about skills. So what an artist needs to do is figure out the skill of marketing. You need to figure out copywriting so that you know how to talk about it. And then you need to figure out selling so that you can get somebody to want to offer you money to do whatever it is you're doing. Even if it's not paying for your art, they just want to support you. And then you need to figure out how to be a better artist so you make stuff that is so good that people come to you.
Right. It, you know, it kind of ties back into what we were saying earlier. It's about passion. You know, you can do so many things in life, but if there is no passion in it, again, why would somebody else see anything in it? If there isn't any passion in there to begin, there's no motion. There's no, it's just blah.
You need passion, but you also need two other things. You need self-awareness and you need discipline. You need self-awareness to know if you're if what you're doing is a waste of your time. Like maybe that's not what you're called to do.
Right.
Maybe the rest of the world is telling you, hey, go in this other direction. This is what we want. But then you also need the discipline to be able to show up consistently and do it. You know, 205 podcasts doesn't happen without effort. And it just so happens that it's aligned with what you're passionate about. So doing it for you feels like play, which makes it easier. But there might be times where you're like, I don't want to edit this. I don't want to post this. Like, I don't want to, this link is broken. I got to fix it. Like, I don't want to do that, but you have to do it. And then self-awareness to know that you, in order to communicate better, you have to remove these idiosyncrasies or learned habits from the way that you communicate because your art or part of your art is communicating with people.
Right.
Which you are, dude, I got to say, I talk to a lot of people and I consider myself a good conversationalist. You're a fucking master, bro.
Thank you. I'll tell you this. I mean, I had a host. We did the podcast together until July of last year. And the day that we were like literally sitting right now, you know, like how we're talking, he messaged me and he's like, oh, I'm not doing this anymore. That could have been the end of the podcast. But I messaged a bunch of people. I literally went through like... like interviewing for hosts, and that started with three and just left with Carissa. And from that, I was able to create a segment with Carissa, which we've been working on since now. Can you think of any projects? You know, it's such an excellent point. Like even like what you're talking about with self-discipline, and I want to touch into this, is realizing like, okay, this failed. So what are you going to do about it? You can stop doing what you're doing, but you could try something else. And that eventually ended into what we have now. But have you ever run into something like that before?
Oh, yeah, where you're left at a decision point, like it'd be easy to quit.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's in the stage world, there's just getting rejected from the companies that you want to go work at or that seem to be the next progression in your opportunity ladder that's ideal, and you get rejected, and it's like, well, I can either go back to the drawing board and figure out why they rejected me, not take it personally. I struggled with that for a long time, or I could just go quit and do something else. There's right. points in my current journey where I'm like, I could go get another tech sales job. and land a cushy base salary with a lot of opportunities and come back to that world as a better communicator, a better salesperson, like better at all crafts, knowing myself better, being much more mentally, physically healthy in every way. Or I could just keep on going, doing what I'm doing because it satisfies me. And I don't want to live with that regret of I gave up when I had something great and I was getting a lot of great feedback. And regret is a guideline. If you feel regret for something, don't do it anymore. That's your conscience telling you that you're acting out of alignment.
Yeah. It's, damn, you bring up really excellent points. And it's kind of strange because we as humans don't realize that our intuition is not just some heebie-jeebie. Like our intuition is our mind having millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of data that is constantly forming and is able to see. We don't realize this as humans, but most of what makes us human is not this. It's in here. All of the stuff that's going on is in the back end. The reason why I'm able to talk the way that I'm doing is in the back of my mind, it's spinning like a fucking like a supercomputer, just throwing information from one neuron to the next. Understanding that and understanding like your intuition, like understanding that if this is not a comfortable situation, like I know you want to be a successful artist. I know you want to be a successful opera singer. I know that you want to be, it's not worth it. You're just going to burn yourself out and then you're just going to quit for reals and never do it again.
You got to listen. Learning to listen to your intuition is a really important thing to, is a really important skill.
Do you have an example of one situation that comes to mind? I'm just curious.
Where I didn't listen to my intuition?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have regrets for things. Like there was a point in my school journey where I left a really great opportunity to go back to something that I already knew. And I left because I was weak. I left because I was scared. I felt really out of place and I just didn't have the maturity and I didn't have like the counsel and the guidance to tell me to stay there in a way that I would have listened. And I went back to something and then I saw it with new eyes and I was like, ooh, this situation is totally broken and like really not where I want to be. Now I have to get out of here. The place that I want to go to, I felt like I couldn't return because it's just too weird, etc. So I took a different path. I ended up where I want to be. If you look, you know, on paper with the opportunities, but yeah, I wasn't able to like really connect and listen to my gut. You know, I was smoking a lot of pot to cope because I was in trouble for drinking. So I wasn't allowed to drink legally. I wasn't legally allowed to drink anyway, but I was getting urinary analysis tests. I was like 19. I was eating a diet full of shit food. I was sleeping in late. I had no discipline. I had really no process for cutting out the noise and listening to myself. What do I want? What am I being guided towards?
Right.
So a couple of years later, I was reading Demian by Hermann Hesse, and something in there said something along the lines of one of the hardest things for a man to do or a person to do is to actually walk and accept what their destiny is. But once they do it, the world opens up for them. And that summer, I had been really pulled towards and was coming into my life a lot of classical music influences. I had gone back to being a Bachelor of Fine Arts in musical theater. And that was when I decided, okay, when I get back from this opportunity, I'm going to figure out how to leave this school again and go commit properly to this path of classical music performance. And when I did that, you know, a lot of people were saying, oh, you'll never be able to have this career. This will never work for you because it's too late, blah, blah, blah. I was like 20, such bullshit. When I did that, as soon as I leaned into that, my whole world accelerated forward. I was getting all kinds of opportunities. I was keeping up with the people that were in the places that I was only aspiring to be. And I had a really blessed path from the moment that I did that. Because I finally learned how to listen to my intuition.
It's sometimes a harsh fact that we realize from our intuition, sometimes in the harshest of ways. And I kind of had that when I was like, I was around 18, 19 years old. I just wanted something. I wanted something more valuable, you know, and something that I can, we don't think about this much, but I don't care about the fact that there's heaven or hell. I don't think that matters. What matters is you're given a certain amount of time. So what are you going to do with it? What am I going to do with my time? You know, and we don't always think that way because we don't want to face the cold, hard truth that our time is valuable as much as corporate America tries to lie to us.
Or say that the most valuable thing you can do is work for them. It's like, no, dude, I was not put here. I was not put here to do this.
No, I was not put on this earth to retire at 65 with backaches and a CPAP machine and yearning to be 90 and just not willing to live. No. I want to be 85 years old and be able to go through a fucking pool and do laps.
Yep. Still be fucking.
Oh, yeah. Come on, bro.
I want to be 30. I want to be 32. You know, I'm 32. I want to be 32 and doing exactly what I want. I want to be 32 and creating and sharing. I want to be 35 and chartering jets. And I want to be 37 or 40, maybe 36, maybe at 35 and just buying one of my own. And then all of the skills and all of the resources that I've marshaled up until that point, using that to put my art out there and help other artists put theirs out there. Really what I want to do, I find so much of this journey is me returning to exactly what I wanted to do as a kid is what I'm being called to do now. I want to make movies and produce my own stuff. I want to connect with other people and collaborate with them and put on little shows and skits. And I want, what's up, Twix? And
she got bored.
I want to basically just help people, hype them up and act as a defender and protector for them when they don't have a voice. Help people see themselves as the main character in their life and step in and say, hey, back the fuck off. You're being a bully when they don't have the strength to do that themselves.
It's strange because then you know, some people get into this mind twist of relying on others for their success. You know, and I think sometimes an independent artists make that great claim of, why do I have to follow your rules? You're not the one that's behind the guitar or in front of the microphone. It's my voice. It's my hands that are doing this. Like, I get it. You're the marketing and you're doing what you can to get this out, but you're taking so much away from me and my creativity. Okay.
And then they take the money from you that you earn through your creativity because they trick you into signing away your rights to it
for years, sometimes 30, 40 years. It's bananas.
If not a lifetime, dude. There's some good books on that. One of them is a book by Robert Greene, you know, the guy who wrote 48 Laws of Power, 33 Strategies of War, etc., or something like
Sounds
that.
Sounds familiar.
He wrote a book with 50 Cent called, yep.
Okay, Paul. You're really into 50 Cent. Okay, you're an official fan right now.
Dude, official fan. 50 Cent is one of my spiritual mentors.
OG classic. It's dude, like...
If I'm in the astral plane and I'm like asking the universe for help, 50 Cent is one of the first people I'm going to call on to be like, 50, guide me.
He literally revolutionized the industry. Like,
Which industry are you talking about? Because he's done a few.
I think the biggest one that most people know is beatboxing scene, just the way that he represents his music in the early... Because you have to remember, like, back in the early 2000s, when you had rap and hip-hop was, you know, becoming a thing, it was very hard for people that came from a different background to kind of relate to it. 50 Cent came around, and he was showing, like, oh my God, I can totally relate with this. This is my story. You know, this is a part of my story. And he did that with how he represented his songs, you know, emphasize on the lyrics, emphasize on the emotions and all of it. And there were a lot of other artists that did it, but the way he did it.
Because 50 Cent has authenticity. It's easy to rap about doing gangster shit, but you're actually not that.
I know.
Whereas 50 Cent, I really believed he was that guy. He's going to, he might show up in my, what does he say? Because your mom is still in the hood and that ain't good. I'm like, if I cross 50 Cent, he might go to my mom's house. I believe it. Other rappers, I'm like, yeah, you're doing this for show. But then he also revolutionized television. And I don't even know too much about how he revolutionized television. But as a producer of power and also starring character in the TV show Power and all of its subsequent spinoffs and some other stuff as well, he has really had a ton of success. There's also the record label. And then there's also the clothing line. And he was an early adopter of using the internet and the forums that it created to connect with his audience and iterate faster. What do they like? What do they not like? He's a really right. perfect example of business and creativity.
Yeah, that actually, because when you have somebody like that, that is able to bring those two ties together, it's so important. And in the end of the day, it has a way of moving more people, you know, connecting with more people. It becomes relatable.
When you're able to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Big time.
That's the work, dude. You just got to become really good at what you do and then figure out the skills to get it out there and get somebody to opt in and say, yeah, I want to support that.
Got to put in that pledge.
Put in that pledge. Support our Patreon.
Can't say that twice. Damn, man. I mean, this is it's a lot to cover. I mean, from cyber to music to life experience, and it's been a lot. It's been a bit long road. I mean, I can't even imagine what it took for you to be where you are now. It's just it's a long road.
A lot of fuck ups, dude.
Question for you: where can people find your stuff? Like your social media, your website?
Yeah, the best place to find me, to connect with me, to see what I'm up to, just to say hey, would be at Michael Hewitt 23, like Michael Jordan, another one of my spiritual mentors.
Nice.
On Instagram and Twitter and YouTube.
Oh, nice! You got a YouTube channel.
Yeah. It's something I need to pay more attention to. Let me make sure that's actually Michael Hewitt 23 on there, and not just Michael Hewitt, but
sure.
Michael Hewitt 23 on all social media is where you want to go. Yep, Michael Hewitt 23 on the YouTube.
Oh, perfect. Yes, you got everything in one safe little spot, and that's awesome, by the way. I feel like YouTube is so stupid easy. Do you know how easy it is? It's literally just copy, click, paste. Takes 5 minutes. It's quicker than making a podcast episode for recording. Isn't that nuts?
That's wild, dude. And that's the platform that I think has the most leverage for people.
Oh yeah. It's really, you know, that's also really important. Like, you know, you mentioned you have your website, you've got your social pages. Just having your content in the right places and being able to get people there is just, it's just perfect. What was your website again? It's just michaelhewitt.com.
Michaelhewitt.com.
HEWIT.com. Perfect. Oh my God. Damn. Well, this has been a wild journey. And let's just say, if you want to listen to the podcast, you can find us at Lost in the Groove Pod. We have our fan page on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and you can watch the YouTube video and us in full Technicolor on YouTube at Lost in the Groove Pod. So, with that, we'll catch you on the next one. Stay groovy, my friends. Bye, everybody.